The following has been brought to you despite great danger. Please listen and heed the warning within. Godspeed and safe listening.
Good evening, my name is Shooter Jennings, and in 2010 I released an album called Black Ribbons. It featured the master of horror, Stephen King, as Will-o'-the-Wisp, a radical radio show host who was hopelessly clinging on during his final night of broadcast before public airwaves were restricted to government-approved transmissions. In this show, we're going to delve into some of the great stories and tales that inspired Black Ribbons. Welcome to Beyond the Black. Episode 2.
The Making of the Music.
Greetings to all our listeners out there tonight. I hope everyone out there has been enjoying Beyond the Black as much as we've enjoyed making it. I also want to remind everybody that my label, Black Country Rock, is going to release the Black Ribbons Ultimate Edition on Election Day that will include the fully remastered double vinyl, one CD of the album, one CD of outtakes and live cuts, as well as downloads of everything, including the Beyond the Black episodes. So as we reach our second episode on the way to this re-release, I'd like to take a moment to talk about the making of the music that went into Black Ribbons. In our first episode, I kept the conversation strictly geared towards the lyrical concepts of the first two songs, without even mentioning the music that was created. My old friend Dave Cobb, who produced the record and just won a couple Grammys, he and I went into the studio in the beginning of 2008 and began constructing the musical landscape of the yet-to-be-titled album. It was right after that cross-country drive I told you about in the first episode. I already had the idea for there to be a character-driven narrative or a radio host or something, but I had yet to reach out to Stephen King, who we'll also get into later, and the story of how he came to be Will-o'-the-Wisp, but that's another story for another episode. Right now, I just want to focus on the music for a moment before we delve into Don't Feed the Animals and The Breaking Point. So Dave and I started working on the album as soon as we entered the studio. We thought we'd kick around for a bit and then bring the band in, which consisted of Ted Russell Camp and Brian Keeling from the newly defunct 357s. I knew that I wanted Dave to play most of the guitar on it, although later we did have Jonathan Wilson come in and play some excellent guitar on it. He just killed it, in my opinion, as well. But back to the story at hand. Basically, Dave and I ended up spending a full year in the studio together before we even brought in the band. I programmed the drums and the keyboards, and he played guitar and bass on the tracks, and we would just experiment day in and out until we had a bunch of instrumental songs that we loved. Occasionally, I would bring in a fully completed song, usually written on the piano. One of these examples of this would be All This Could Have Been Yours. That was really written at home, and I brought it in, and we cut that live with the band in the room. Wake Up was also written at home like this, but pre-programmed and constructed before the band came in. You can tell which songs were built before the live band was brought in because most of them still have remaining drum machines from the programming I did on them. Previous to this album, I had released 3 country albums, although you could make the case that if you took out my 3rd album, called The Wolf, and went directly from my 2nd album, Electric Rodeo, to Black Ribbons, it doesn't seem like such a huge sonic leap. We had already experimented a lot on Electric Rodeo with psychedelic influences, as well as some programming and heavier riffs and beats. But essentially, I was free with this album. I already knew from day one that I was going to be using the fictional band Hierophant as a mask. I hadn't named them yet, but I knew I was going to use it as a tool, and it would allow me to do anything that I wanted without worrying about what people thought about this being the new Me album, if you know what I mean, not to sound too narcissistic. As far as the sound of the music went, Dave and I spent weeks and months just kicking around experimental tracks for me to write around. And there are tons of instrumentals that did make the album. I'm even including a few of those in the bonus material with the Black Ribbons Ultimate Edition. Much like Beyond the Black, these tracks will help you get inside my head during the creation of Black Ribbons and will allow you access to some of what almost made it on the album. We would start with a very basic idea, a drum beat or a riff, and just build on it. For a song like Don't Feed the Animals, that started with me putting down a very Nine Inch Nails inspired beat and Dave throwing some distortion on the guitar and playing a riff, and then flipping that riff backwards. Then we just worked off of that riff, and that tune, honestly, was one of the hardest ones for me to come up with lyrics to, because it was just driven so fiercely by the music. It was almost intimidating. The same held true for Everything Else is Illusion. For that tune, I even had to bring in a good friend of mine, Matt White, from the band Earl Greyhound, to help me write it, and he sang on it as well. He also turned me on to the book The Hero Within by Carol Pearson. Will of the Wisp speaks about that in the break right before Fuck You, I'm Famous. But back to the story. I suppose what I'm trying to get across to all of you is our mentality and the musical mindset that we had during the creation of the album's music. If something felt too much like a normal tune or got too bar bandy, we would just scrap it immediately. Sometimes we would attempt to rework the song or to make them more interesting, but pretty much if we got down on a tune, it would just be gone from the lot and we'd move on and make a new one. We would construct the dynamics of the songs as we went along, instead of looking at it through the lens of a normal song structure. I think this, in retrospect, gave the album a lot of the freshness that still holds up today. We were definitely not chasing any kind of feedback from radio or anyone else. Hell, I thought my career was over. This was really something that came from deep inside and busted out of my chest like I was John Hurt in the movie Alien. Anyway, I just wanted to shed some light on the musical side of the album's creation before we dove into the next songs and the related tales. Episode 2, Don't Feed the Animals, and The Breaking Point. Darker when the sun goes down and the streets and the valleys on the animals roar. Don't feed the animals. Things get darker when the sun goes down and the streets and the valleys on the animals roar.
There's a real sense of mourning in Antrim today as the reality of what happened on Saturday night begins to sink in. Some we spoke to described the killers of the two soldiers as animals.
So if you are just joining us, two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire about an hour and a half ago at a high school.
I've never seen anything of this magnitude. This is utter lawlessness. And if you don't bring in the troops, by the time you're going to get through, all you're going to have is ashes.
It's gotten extremely violent down here. We've got protest groups that are not just protesting. They are throwing bottles. They are throwing pool balls. They are breaking windows. They are coming after the media. They are going after cop cars. They're breaking windows. And they are hell-bent on causing as much harm and destruction.
I guess the darker side of life and the nightlife have always fascinated me. Maybe it was because I was a child traveling on the road with my parents, country singers, and I saw these rowdy venues and honky-tonks and places they would play. Or maybe it was simply honestly that I wasn't that wild of a child. And I hadn't really experienced what you would call the real nightlife until I was in my early 20s. I moved to Los Angeles when I was 20, screaming to be on my own so I could finally go wild. And go wild I did. But for this episode, I would like to combine the two songs at hand to make a discussion of a bigger theme. Don't Feed the Animals is a song about the beast within. In every human, there lies something dark beneath. This very concept has permeated our culture from the ancient werewolf and vampire myths to like video games like Altered Beast.
rise from your grave.
And comic book villains like the Joker. Some of us walk the path of the righteous man. Some of us walk the path of selfishness and evil. But some pretend to do the former while really doing the opposite. That is the case that is definitely most dangerous of all people. Personally, I like someone who is forthcoming about what they stand for, even if I don't agree with it. It's nice to know you can at least see the whole deck on the table. I don't want to play cards with Harvey Dent. It's too hard to read his real face. You know what I'm saying? The potential of evil, this beast, lies within. It's waiting inside of every man and woman. Assuming you're a somewhat decent individual, have you ever thought about what it would be like if you broke bad, to use the term from the television show? What would be your breaking point? See what I did there? Seriously, though, have you ever wondered if you were able to decide one day to turn your back on your family or friends and do something terribly selfish or morally questionable? I know I've thought about it, and it's almost like a feeling of, what am I capable of? Am I capable of evil? Or something even worse? Once you open your mind to that, you have to ponder, is my best friend or my wife capable of breaking bad, of going evil? It's something to think about. The world is a very dangerous place, and if you're out of the house late at night, you're just asking for something bad to happen. That's the truth. It's a risk. The nighttime brings the bad. It doesn't always happen, but it does. In an interesting article from Psychology Today, writer and psychologist Andrea F. Pollard writes, "Recent studies by Rice University shows that when subjects are exposed to disgusting images, they tend to lie and cheat at harmless activity, a game for example, afterwards. The feeling of disgust protects us from coming in contact with something that could poison us, meaning the experience alerts us to act aggressively in behalf of our own survival." Okay, interesting. Disgusting pictures. Protecting us. Things that make you go, as CNC Music Factory would say. She continues, "Another study shows how easily compassion gets thrown out the window. When put under time pressure by the experimenter, subjects who ordinarily would help the helpless practically step over a poor guy lying on the floor holding his stomach. Also, when people, men and women alike, come into power, such as a high political office, they suddenly overestimate their attractiveness and increase their feelings of entitlement, whether for more power or more sex. As soon as we become an animal concerned with self-preservation, including the preservation of our genes, we may just break bad and become narcissistic." Very interesting. The concept of narcissism has always fascinated me. In Greek mythology, Narcissus was a hunter from Thespiae in Boeotia who was known for his striking beauty. He was the son of the river god Cephisus and nymph Liriope. Narcissus was proud in that he disdained those who loved him. Nemesis noticed this behavior and attracted Narcissus to a pool where he saw his own reflection in the water and fell in love with it, not realizing it was merely an image. Unable to leave the beauty of his own reflection, Narcissus lost his will to live. He stared at his reflection until he died. Sometimes you gotta wonder how all the narcissistic fucks out in the world today can even leave their houses. They must have removed all the mirrors and reflective surfaces, I guess. But from an archetypal psychology standpoint, I think it gives a pretty clear description of the horrible phenomenon known as selfies. I gotta even stop before I delve into the implication it has on internet trolls, social justice warriors, or about anybody else who's so in love with themselves they feel they need to force-feed their own views on everybody else. But I digress. Back to the Walter White scenario. I can think of one glaring example of a very famous public figure breaking bad, and that is O.J. Simpson. Don't worry, I'm not going to delve into the O.J. case. We've seen enough rehash on that lately, and I'm sure it's pretty fresh in everybody's minds. Besides, narcissism is just one of the ingredients that can cook up a big old batch of Breaking Bad casserole. The pressures of the world around you to fit in or follow some kind of guideline can also place a heavy weight on somebody more weak-willed than others. Look at the Columbine kids. These were kids who were picked on and probably came from a home where they didn't feel the kind of importance or strength that comes from a very healthy, loving home. Our society and the microcosm of schools, which are supposed to prepare these pre-adults for introduction into said society, push many children aside as outcasts or freaks. But what's the solution? Participation trophies? I hardly think celebrating nothing can help. In the case of the Columbine teens, who knows what caused their last card to fall? We will never know that. A lot of people will blame influences, video games, musicians, whatever scapegoat they want to find, but the truth lies somewhere within the hearts of those young men turned mass murderers. It seems to me it would be a combination of the desire to fit in, coupled with the rejection that followed, mixed with the narcissism that goes along with the notoriety they knew they would receive for committing such a heinous act. I mean, for real, these kids started a domino effect that is still going on today. And it seems that the dominoes that fall crooked do more and more damage on the way down. Society does put pressure on you, though, and it's something that you have to tune out. While I am a very spiritual person, raised by a religious person and a religious family on my mom's side, I've never been a fan of organized religion. Religion plays a very dire part in this idea we're talking about. The idea of religion itself is to give us guidelines, to set up a model of living that will result in morally sound decisions and a healthy society. It is not intended to be a rule book or law of any sort, in my opinion, but more of a moral compass. My opinion and yours may be different, and hey, that's okay. We're allowed to think differently from one another. That's what being free is about. But in my opinion, religion can be a form of bullying, or at least result in it. I know most of us have probably experienced a bully one way or another in our lives. I know I have. I remember this kid from school. I was going to say his name, but let's not. Let's call him Dildo Baggins. How about that? What a fucking prick this kid was. He'd punch on me and beat on me. He'd try and push me as far as he could to see if I'd break. I mean, this kid was a real piece of shit. And it turns out his dad liked to stick his thumb in Dildo Baggins' back just for him to be tougher. He thought Dildo Baggins was a little sissy pie and he needed to be a more manly badass like his dad, per se. I remember going over to his house when I was really little and seeing all these like zebra and giraffe and elephant skins everywhere. His dad would leave on these illegal hunting trips all the time, killing baby giraffes for game and shit. Another real piece of shit, you know what I'm saying? But he wanted Dildo Baggins to be a real man all the time. And he came down on him. And he probably beat the shit out of him too when he was at home, if he wasn't performing like his dad wanted him to. One of those numbers. That shit just leads to more violence. This kid was probably picking on me and the other non-jocks because he had to make someone else feel the fear he had for his dad. That's really pathetic. And I'm sure he's somewhere right now making someone's fucking life hell and drinking his daddy disappointing balls right off. He's probably beating his kids and his third or fourth wife. Who knows, maybe he's produced four or five more bullies for the current generation. Either way, this is another part of why society's pressures can really drive someone who doesn't understand why to a breaking point.
She came to me with dust in her mouth. Chanel tears and looking like a millionaire. I could see she'd reached her breaking point. I could see she'd reached her breaking point, just like me. Spend all your love on the silver cup, and all your gold on a second place club. Ain't no way to make you happy. Only one thing can make me happy, and that's you.
One night in April of 2009, a year of internet battle ended in 5 seconds when Wade, 19 at the time, stabbed and killed her romantic rival.
That's saying a masked gunman has shot dead several people and wounded many others at a midnight premiere of the new Batman film, The Dark Knight.
We are learning more tonight about six suspects tied to a triple murder in Tennessee.
The Breaking Point. In a great blog by DJ Wilson for the Huffington Post, he shares a story that he heard in a Nashville writing session. It's the tale of a teacher who saved a young man from doing something he might regret. Crossing that line can always lead to more. Evil multiplies. DJ writes, "In the late 50s, Paul was teaching at a high school in Madison, Tennessee, and since every school has at least one bully, Madison was no exception. As a matter of fact, this bully, who we'll call Billy, was renowned across campus as an individual who always had money, especially since it was extorted daily from others too scared to say no, fearful of a knuckle sandwich, or worse. One of Paul's duties as a teacher was to patrol the hallways during lunch period. On one particular day, he witnessed Billy threatening a much smaller boy who we'll call Jim outside the lunchroom. Recognizing Jim from his homeroom class, Paul knew that he was quiet and didn't interact much with others and was basically invisible. Except today, he wasn't. Drawing the ire of Billy, and from the looks of things, his wrath. Billy raised his fist and charged Jim, full tilt. Suddenly, Paul saw the flash of a steel blade appear in the hand of Jim, and time, as he knew it, stood still. One of the principles of disciplining students in a fight is to go to the first student you know best. Being young and inexperienced in such matters, Paul immediately rushed towards Jim with his hand extended. "Give me the switchblade, Jim," demanded Paul. "No one will hurt you today on my watch." Jim eyed Paul for a few moments, allowing his anger to subside, before he finally surrendered the knife. Paul closed the switchblade, dropping it in his pocket, and led Jim by the arm to the principal's office, leaving Billy standing alone, speechless. The head principal was away for the day, so Paul used his office anyway. The penalty for threatening another student or teacher with a weapon was automatic expulsion, not only from the school, but from the entire school system. Paul was in a quandary. Jim, as far as Paul knew, was an excellent student. His record in deportment was spotless. His dad was a local minister, his mom an elementary school principal. When Paul began to address the seriousness of the situation, Jim broke down, releasing weeks of pent-up frustration and cried tears of extreme remorse. Paul talked about his options. Then Jim talked and Paul listened. It seems that Billy had been threatening Jim for several weeks and had him at the breaking point. He couldn't eat and he couldn't sleep. He couldn't study. Today, Jim decided, in order for him to survive another day, he had to stand up to Billy and fight. After what seemed like the longest 30 minutes of Paul's life, he reached in his pocket, flipped open the knife, broke the blade off between the top drawer and the desk, and tossed it in the trash. Then Paul told Jim to return to class. He even provided a late slip. The next day, Billy approached Paul in the hall. He said, "Why is Jim still in school? He pulled a knife on me. He should have been expelled." Paul looked Billy straight in the eyes and said, "What knife?" A decade or so later, with Paul still teaching at Madison, in the middle of a history exam, he happened to look out his classroom window to see a soldier in full dress uniform exiting a cab at the front entrance of the school. Thinking more nothing of it, Paul returned to his desk, only to be interrupted by a determined knock at his classroom door. Opening the door, before Paul stood a highly decorated green beret. It was Jim. He grabbed Paul's hand and spoke softly. "I'm going back to Vietnam tomorrow, sir. I could not leave again before thanking you for what you did for me by making it possible for me to finish high school. I hope I have and will continue to make you proud." Then Jim stood at attention, saluted Paul, and walked away. Paul never saw or heard from the Green Beret again. Isn't that a great story? Again, that was DJ Wilson for the Huffington Post, a story that he had been told. I bet that bully was fucking pissed as hell. I mean, that kid pulled a knife on him and got away with it. But the bully deserved that. He got off light. He should have been thankful. Most of these kids who shoot up their schools or shoot up movie theaters or black churches or whatever, they all seem to have one thing in common. They were a beta, and the alpha had made them feel it every single day. It was tough. I mean, my school was tough in its own way, but I made it through it without shooting up the whole school, killing all my friends, and jumping ship. But these pressures don't even add up compared to that put in place by the non-secular sect of society. Look at the misguided minds brainwashed by radical Islam. This guy in Orlando. An act of pure evil. Killed 50 people in a gay nightclub, claiming it was a killing for Allah and for ISIS. but then it turns out that this guy's really screwed up in the head. Somewhere deep inside, he's struggling with his own sexuality, having secret hookups with men, etc. Of course, we don't know this man, or at least, I don't know him. So all of this is hearsay, but it's worth thinking about. Radical Islam or not, devout, by-the-book Muslims truly believe that being gay is a sin and evil. It says the same thing in the Bible, and in both cases, you'll see that some Christians and Muslims are more understanding despite what the religion says, but let's go by the ones who are radically by the book. Omar Mateen clearly has been told by his family and his religion that being gay is evil, and in his shame, he hides his own tendencies in fear of being found out and cast out by his family and shamed by Islam. So eventually, this dude breaks bad. Yes, I know that we've been told that he scouted Disney World as a target place, and that would kind of partially discredit this he was really gay and self-hating and just went evil and killed himself in a grand manner theory. Perhaps he thought he would win the praise of his father, who supports the Taliban and Sharia law, and the praise of the church. If it is true that he was secretly homosexual, then possibly he thought that this was a way to wash those sins clean by killing other homosexuals and ending his own life. But I feel that either way, he was going to kill himself. I think Howard Stern said it too, that it seems like these guys are just nut jobs who 15 years ago would have just killed themselves. But now, because they see with the internet and all that what they can get out of it by going out with a bang, so to speak, no pun intended, it seems much more grand. Maybe now they're just killing themselves and trying to take out as many people as they can with them and just using ISIS as a scapegoat to get more attention. Who knows? It's evil. That's the point, plain and simple. It's same with these shootings of the police officer. I know firsthand about corrupt cops, and there's plenty of them, but killing random officers to make a point is without point. And honestly, just plain, low-down, yellow. These guys wanted to kill themselves first and foremost, and just found a way to go about it and be all over the media. And the media, the fucking media, like I said. According to our TVs and social media, the world is falling apart and full of hate and terror, and it doesn't even feel safe to go outside. On top of that, the earth is dying, and we're all headed for global extinction at our own hands. But when you go outside, you see people in love. You see children having fun, a beautiful, healthy world. People are still going on first dates at the soda shop on Elliston Place in Nashville. Couples, families, and friends are still in the paddle boats in Echo Park in East Los Angeles. There are still children laughing and playing in Central Park in New York City. Our world is far from dark. But if the media had it their way, this is how they would want you to see it. Fuck the media. Fuck the politicians. Fuck the long line political families. They're trying to control our perception of reality so that we may be controlled. But let me adjust my suit and tie here and get off my tirade. Moving on to other odd tales of the evil within, I thought I would touch on a few other famous people notorious for their hidden evil, and even some more recent ones that might have been covered up by the press with all the distractions that we're faced with during this election cycle. There's a lot going on you aren't hearing about because CNN is spending all their airtime trying to keep Trump out of the White House, or that the New York Post cares more about Hillary Clinton's emails than they care about stories that might make you feel better about the world we all live in together. Remember, the owner of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post. You think he's ever going to let you read something that would hurt his mega-billion-dollar shopping empire? Do you think you're going to get the straight truth from any of these sources? They're all owned by billionaires and Wall Street and corporations that have vested interest in controlling the media. But we have always been subservient to the television. That is, until the internet came along. A decentralized source of media. It changes everything. It is still changing everything. But the media has no power anymore. Unfortunately, the power has been shifted to the tech companies. And Twitter and Facebook are censoring posts. They're promoting what they want, their political agenda. Trust no one on this except for your gut. They are controlling that, but there will be a time when we're communicating publicly in a decentralized manner in which they cannot hide the truth. And that is the internet that we are looking for. That's why Bitcoin, again, I bring it up, it's decentralized money payment. You can control your money without a bank or the IRS taking your money from you. You can even send your money across the world for pennies. But the point is, these steps are coming, they are happening. But you can't trust Facebook, and you can't trust Twitter. You can't trust anyone who's making money off of your material. That's what's happening right now. That will change. But the media, they were the old guard. The politicians, the corporations, they controlled the media and they controlled the people's perception of reality. But with the internet, you know the truth, what really happens, from people who are sharing what's really happening. But to continue, let's go back and look over some of the more famous folks who let the beast within take over. Everybody knows about Jeffrey Dahmer. Dahmer experienced a pretty normal childhood, but with an early surgery for a double hernia, Dahmer became more withdrawn and socially anxious. According to several different biographies on Dahmer, he became obsessed with necrophilia and murder in his early teens. Before even reaching his 20s, he had already killed a hitchhiker and eventually dismembered and crushed the remains, burying them on his family's land. All of this led to extreme alcoholism, which fueled most of his muted judgment, to say the least. Over the next 13 years, he killed, raped, and often ate over 16 young men. Some he even had sex with post-mortem. All of whom thought he was a nice guy to begin with, and then when he got him home and got him drunk, he tortured him and killed him. Another not-so-high-profile one is the story of Colleen Stan. This young woman was kidnapped and held as a sex slave by Cameron and Janice Hooker in Red Bluff, California. They basically kept her in this box 23 hours a day. They'd let her out for 1 hour, and at first didn't sexually abuse her. They just messed with her mind. Cameron had convinced his wife to let him do this, to take her, but he promised her he wouldn't sleep with her. But he kept telling the young lady, Colleen, all these stories of a group called The Company that was going to kill her and all of her family and all the neighbors if she ever let anyone know she was in there. And he kept doing this over and over and over and giving her entertainment during the 1 hour a day, but always reiterating the story of The Company. On the first night she was kidnapped, she was strung up by the hands and beaten by Cameron. She was left blindfolded and suspended while Cameron and Janice had sex below her that night. Later, Cameron started sleeping with her. He started raping her. And this consisted of oral rape, as Cameron did not want to have sex with Stan vaginally because he considered that to be a breach of his agreement with his wife. Then he also penetrated Stan with various things, vaginally and anally, but not his penis. Anyway, eventually they moved to a small mobile home somewhere, and then it caused a huge fight and all this. She finally escaped, and it was crazy. But towards the end of her captivity, he had brainwashed her so bad about The Company that he started letting her even visit her own family, and they thought she was okay because she was putting on a whole front because she thought The Company was going to kill everyone. Finally, she escaped when Janice Hooker started to freak out because her husband wanted to get 4 more sex slaves. This was Janice's breaking point. Soon after, she started talking to the police and informed them of what had happened, as well as another girl that they had tortured at an earlier point in the relationship. Very wild stuff, but the evil in Cameron had already brainwashed his wife into making this okay, and then they went and took this poor woman and put her in a box for 23 hours a day for 8 years, raping her and abusing her. Horrible stuff. There was a TV special called Girl in a Box you can go and watch about this, but it's just one of the nasty cases of someone who's let that inner beast take control and kill them as a human. Much like Ariel Castro's famous Cleveland kidnappings, a lot of these people are perceived as normal, with monsters on the inside ready to strike. Hell, Ariel Castro had a band and a job. So here he is, out jamming the blues at gigs, playing bass while he had 3 young women at his home ready to rape and torture when he got home. You never know what is on the inside. One final tale that I'll unwind in this episode is about the Kennedy family. You see, the media has done a very good job of blurring the last century. The Kennedy family is revered in many ways and treated like royalty. But they had some very dark skeletons in their closets. And we're talking Skeletor on steroids and PCP kind of skeletons. We can talk about the great things that JFK stood for, or how handsome JFK Jr. was and who he dated. Hell, even Ted Kennedy might have done some good things in his life. But when faced with certain situations, how one reacts under pressure really shows what they're made of. Let's talk about Ted for a minute. Get the obvious out of the way. I'm sure some of you have heard of the Chappaquiddick incident. On Chappaquiddick Island, Massachusetts, in the summer of 1969, Ted Kennedy drove his car off a bridge into a tidal channel. He swam free and waited 9 hours to report the incident. The only problem is that there was a passenger in that car. A young woman named Mary Jo Kopechne was in the passenger seat of that car and drowned in the river. Ted swam free. He went home and he didn't even call the cops until 9 hours later. 9 hours later! A diver testified that he believed that she had been suffocated and not drowned because of how he believed that there was no water in her lungs. Ted was charged for fleeing the scene, but that was all. This is why he didn't run for president in 1972 like everyone thought he was going to. He killed the girl, he covered it up, and got away with it. All because he's a Kennedy. Ain't life grand? Yes, some would argue that he did some good things as a senator, and some would argue against it. But that dude clearly killed that woman and got away with it. Corruption! Wake up! I mean, this is what it's all about. Then there's John F. Kennedy. No, not his assassination. His shenanigans. To be honest with you, that motherfucker was a twisted, dark bastard. Matthew DeLuca wrote an article on the memoirs of JFK mistress Mimi Alford for the Daily Beast, delving into the juiciest parts of the book. Apparently, she had a steamy affair at 19 with JFK. He had her hired as an intern and started out giving her menial jobs. Then he started to orchestrate her falling for him in a very dark way. He had people essentially inviting her to things with really swanky crowds, impressing her, and putting her in the same room with the president. They'd set him up so he could come in and knock him down. His team was already used to deflecting his affairs, so this was a conquest and an orchestrated one. There's a young girl that he wanted, so he set it up with his power. A really twisted reality control type situation. And then, as the affair went on, the narcissistic abuse began to take center stage. Recalling the affair in the book, DeLuca writes, "It was a passionate but not a loving affair," Alford reflects. She and Kennedy never kissed, and she always referred to him as Mr. President. While for the most part she was drawn in by Kennedy's playfulness and charisma, Alford writes a number of moments when she saw Kennedy's darker side. On a trip west with the president during the winter of her sophomore year, Mimi accompanied Kennedy to a party at Bing Crosby's house in Palm Springs, California. With the president surrounded by a fast Hollywood crowd, someone offered him amyl nitrate, or poppers. When Mimi refused to try the drug, Kennedy made her inhale the fumes anyway. Of another story in the book, Matt DeLuca writes, "During a noonday swim with David Powers sitting at the edge of the pool while Kennedy and Mimi splashed around, the president said to her, 'Mr. Powers looks a little tense. Would you take care of it?' Understanding that she was being instructed to give Powers oral sex, Mimi obliged. Kennedy asked her to do the same thing for his younger brother, Senator Ted Kennedy, months later," Alford writes, "but this time, with the affair winding down, she refused." You see, fame, power, and money are like a chemical of evil, of excess, and of narcissism. It's like the Joker's wet dream, a currency that funds the life support for the beast inside each and every one of us. The beast feeds on the fame and the money and the power. And if not kept in check, all perception of reality becomes warped. The monster is so big that it takes over the man. Treating a young woman like this kind of abuse, just shows the kind of mentality that someone in the position of JFK has. How the not-so-innocent but at least sane affair with the young 19-year-old girl woman turned into a dark play with actors untouchable from the law. But to me, there is nothing more horrific than the story of Rosemary Kennedy, who is the oldest daughter of the Kennedy family and sister to JFK, Robert, and Ted Kennedy. She apparently was showing learning problems and wasn't into sports like the other athletic members of her family. She also seemed to be a girl on her own path, and she really refused to obey their father, Joseph Sr. They said that she had an IQ of an 8-year-old, but who knows what the truth was. To me, it sounded like she refused to take part in her family's bullshit. To friends, Joseph never said that she had mental problems. But in all accounts, after her lobotomy, he continued to push the idea that she was borderline retarded. Yes, I said lobotomy. Joseph Kennedy Sr. forced his 23-year-old daughter, Rosemary Kennedy, to have a partial frontal lobe lobotomy. This left her a vegetable, and then they committed her. How horrific. This man took his own child and essentially banished her to a life of shitting herself in a cook house because she wouldn't listen to him. What an example of sharp as a razor evil. The beast within their father was that of the greatest horror films, but nobody talks about any of this when they talk about the Kennedys. This family was full of monsters. This family bred monsters. This family was evil, and if you dig more, you'll find 1,000 more stories like it. It almost makes you wonder if things like JFK's assassination or Ted's brain tumor were some kind of cosmic karma or the universe trying to cure itself from some sort of cancer. Either way, there we have it. The beast within. But the positive? The light is always love. Everything else is illusion. And this is going to be our first topic on episode 3 of Beyond the Black. But if you want a child to have a happy, productive life, you have to put in just as much love as you have and feed the beauty inside. You can only get out what you put in. Throwing money at your children isn't feeding the light, it's feeding the dark. Buying them everything they want is fine as long as it comes with an equal amount of love to fulfill their sunrise and bring them towards a beautiful twilight and sunset. If you don't have kids, then use your life to make art, music, films, books, or other forms of expression that tell your story and share your feelings. Sometimes just knowing someone else feels like you do can stop someone from turning fully inward for the dark side. If you look down through history, people's legacies of good are filled by acts of understanding and friendship. If you've had a hard life, tell us about it. Share it with us. Share your story of grief and hardship with me at shooter@beyondthe.black. That's shooter@beyondthe.black. During the life of this series, I will try and write you all back with some words of inspiration to maybe put a smile on your face. Remember, Black Ribbons is about love. Love is the only truth, and everything else is illusion. Good always wins. Sometimes it just takes a little longer than we would all hope for. Until September 10th, be good to each other. And remember, Black Ribbons is coming out on Election Day. The ultimate pack, all the great stuff that comes with it, including every episode of Beyond the Black. Go to bcrmedia.com for more information. Beyond the Black was written and produced by Shooter Jennings and Brad Jewell and is a production of BCR Los Angeles in association with J&J Productions. Until next episode, don't feed the animals.
Secure transmission. Stay tuned for future messages. Everything is illusion.